Good evening, and thank you for coming out on a, on the one hand, snowy night. On the other hand, it's February in Toronto, and this isn't really snow. So, we'll give everybody credit. Thank you very much for spending some time with us on Sunday evening. I want to give special thanks to Yeshivat Or Chaim for hosting the program here in our home base Medrash. This is where Beit Midrash Zichron Dov spends most of our time. And of course, I want to give special thanks to Rabbi Tzvi Heber, Director of Community Kosher for the COR, without whom this program would look very different, meaning it wouldn't involve kosher expertise. It would be someone talking about business ethics, which is nice, but that's not quite what we're looking for. Rabbi Heber has been a good friend to our Beit Midrash, really, I think, going back, I don't know, 8, 9, maybe even 10 years at this point. I have sent my Reichim to Rabbi Heber. We had him speak to us about various issues in kashrus. And also personally, someone I know I can turn to with questions and issues that that come up, and somebody who I recommend that people in general should turn to, not to flood you with more email than you already get. But if you look at the source sheets, you'll see on the second page Rabbi Heber's heading. It has his email address. He does read and respond. This program came about because of a question that, or a set of questions that I received at a Shul Kiddush about some of the issues that we're going to be discussing this evening. I'm always open to those kinds of conversations and glad for the impetus for a program. So if people have other ideas, I'd be glad to hear it. The format for this evening is basically two presentations, call it 30 to 35 minutes or so for each. And I'll be speaking about the issues that are more about business ethics, and then Rabbi Heber is going to speak about issues that are more about kashrus organizations. Neither of us represents each other. We prepared our remarks separately. The sheets are together, but please don't hold him accountable for any mistakes in mine. That's for sure. We will then have some questions and question-answer time at the end, God willing. Rabbi Sammy Bergman is the sgan for our Beit Midrash. He's sitting over there. If you have a question, please submit it in writing to Rabbi Bergman. He has pencils and index cards there for anyone who would like writing materials. Please do me a favor. Make sure to stress to write the question clearly on the card. The more concise, the more precise, the better. And after the presentations are over, after both presentations, then we'll speak about the questions, time permitting. We can have a Ma'ariv Minyan at the end if there is sufficient interest in that. One last point, but a very important point. Even though Rabbi Heber is kind enough to come participate, we are not representing the COR with this. Questions about COR policy should be communicated to the COR. Nothing I say, and I think also nothing he says tonight, should be taken as COR policy. Okay, so that first 3 minutes was not in my 30 to 35 for those for those keeping score. If you look at the sheets, you'll see at the top of the first page the three questions that I am tackling. Number one, is it ethical for a commercial conscious organization to receive tax benefits as a charitable organization? Number two, may a commercial conscious organization decline to certify food at an event for non-conscious reasons like halakhically problematic entertainment? For those who don't know what I'm talking about, you can take a look at source number one, one of many, many articles you can find online. If you Google Glatyat, for example, you can find information about that. This article references the Glatyat case, which was a case of, as it sounds, a ship that served kosher food, but involved certain activities which were not necessarily kosher. And it also mentions a case that happened in Israel, in which a woman was dancing, belly dancing, it appears, at restaurants and in banquet halls, and the supervising agencies pulled hashgacha, they pulled their certification. So the question that I have is it okay for a commercial kosher organization to decline to certify fully kosher food in a setting like that? And then third, may a commercial kosher organization certify products that don't require kosher supervision? And you've all seen these sorts of things, the bathroom cleaner, the bottled water, and so forth. So those are our three questions. So I want to begin with the first question, the tax benefits question, it comes up actually a lot on anti-Semitic websites. Very interesting. I don't know how much time you spend on anti-Semitic websites. I don't really recommend it. But if you take a look at source number two, a website called The Kosher Question. Should the kosher certification industry operate under a benevolent, quote, income-free basis, as religious organizations often do, rather than tax-exempt, revenue-driven businesses? Wouldn't it be morally righteous for the various religious agencies to provide charitable kosher certification of products for those who demand it? In other words, don't charge. Just walk into the facilities, check it out, make sure everything is okay. Instead, this certification industry operates with an enormous revenue stream, all tax-free because of its religious organization status. I smile and laugh as I read this because when I lived in Allentown, Pennsylvania, we had a local VOD. And the only way our VOD stayed afloat was because we also had under the same umbrella a Chevra Kedisha. And the Chevra Kedisha never lost money. And therefore, they were able to fund the budget of the VOD HaKasher. So I don't know where this enormous revenue stream is. But it wasn't in the Lehigh Valley. That I will tell you. Nonetheless, the issue here is that most consumers are not members in the congregation that is extracting income from such certification and usually receive no benefit from the programs they fund, right? Most taxpayers are not, in fact, kosher consumers. That's true. They are not given transparent disclosure to the amount of income derived, nor where it goes. They cannot pressure the organizations to be clear on financial reporting with a threat of, quote, leaving the congregation. Not having this leverage to disclose financials goes against the original arguments in our Congress that permitted religious organizations to operate tax-free without reporting their numbers. There's a lot of misinformation going on in this paragraph. And I want to unpack it a little bit because it's really important that when you discuss these issues, you actually know what you're talking about. So, misinformation number one is legal. And that is that a VOD, a kosher supervising agency, should not qualify for a tax exemption, and then somehow the government is being fooled into supporting the Jews. The truth of the matter is that government believes that having niche organizations serve particular populations benefits the country as a whole. So it is that there are tax breaks for art museums. There are tax breaks for youth programs. And yes, there are tax breaks for religious organizations. But the CRA filing of the COR, which is readily available online, is entirely consistent with what the government of Canada calls advancement of religion. I gave you the government's definition in source number three for what qualifies as advancement of religion. And then you can see the CRA listing in number four, the COR listing, excuse me, in number four. The charity promotes the observance of Orthodox Judaism by ensuring the availability and identification of kosher products through its supervision and certification of food service production. I think that's basically what it does. The government posts it on its website. From the government's perspective, this fits something which they wish to support. They believe it's good for the nation as a whole. The wool is not being pulled over anybody's eyes. That's number one. Number two, the point that's made in source number two about the lack of transparency, I don't know whether the author of that article is internet savvy, but the CRA has a wonderful website. The IRS has a pretty good website in the U.S. as well. And generally speaking, organizations that qualify for tax breaks have to make filings online. And if you look at number five, I created a bit.ly link to make it really, really easy for people. If anyone wants this email to them so that they don't even have to retype the link, I'll be glad to email you the source sheet. But if you go there, you will find numerous filings with all the financial data, how much they made, where it went, the whole bit. It's all there online. There's no lack of transparency. And then finally, there's a related bit of business misinformation. Specifically, that when a VOD charges a company for supervision, that drives up the price, including for people who are not Jewish and or don't keep kosher. This is what's known on the internet as, anybody know? No. I mean, yes, but, sorry? It's called the kosher tax. That's what they call it. So first of all, the cost per product when you're manufacturing on an industrial level. I'm not talking now about someone's private event, something going on in a particular venue. I'm talking about manufacturing. The cost per product is actually negligible. I gave you a quote which the ADL has on their website in number 6. They quote a New York Times article that reported the cost to General Foods bird's eye unit is 6.5 millionth of a cent per item. 6.5 millionths of a cent. They also had in the same article, but I was really, sticking to one page, so I didn't bring it. They had a quote from Heinz. The representative of the Heinz company said the per item cost is, quote, so small we can't even calculate it. But aside from the minimal cost that's actually involved from the company, remember why the company gets into kosher supervision at all. Why is it that a non-Jewish owned company is interested in getting certification, or a Jewish owned company for that matter?
Business.
Correct. So what do you think the company does if they find that the cost of certification is higher than the business it brings in? What do you think they do? They drop hashkafa. They don't raise the price of the item to pay for something that's not actually bringing in returns. I can tell you that because I had that experience with my bod. We had a company that felt like they weren't seeing the returns, and the answer was, thank you very much, but try again later. The companies get supervision because it improves sales, because they want to raise the price, not because they want to raise the price of production. It's advertising. That's essentially what it is. And if having certification doesn't work, they don't raise the cost of the product. They simply drop hashgacha. So that's just in terms of some of the misinformation that we're talking about. But let's get to the parts that are more substantive. Because the tax-exempt question has a key substantive element to it as well. Which is, when he asks the question on that website, maybe they should be doing it for free. Because in fact, halachically, we ask that question. Are you allowed to take money for engaging in a mitzvah? And the answer is, no. You're not allowed to take money for engaging in a mitzvah. This is a very, very old question. If you take a look at source number 8, I'm going to come back to 7 in a second, but I gave a shiur on this topic for doctors on the question of whether doctors are allowed to charge. And you can see it there at that link. You can hear that shiur. There I discussed this at much greater length. But if you go back to number 7, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law says, HaRofei Asur Litol Schar HaChochma VaHalimud. A doctor is not allowed to take payment for conveying knowledge and teaching to the patient. I'm going to come back to the rest of the line in a moment. But what he says right there, and it's not the Shulchan Aruch's invention, this goes back to the Gemara in Nedarim, is that a doctor is not allowed to take payment for medical advice. However, the Torah assumes that there is payment to doctors. The Torah talks about it. In the event that one person attacks another and causes him an injury, the rule is that the assailant has to pay various forms of restitution, and one of those is medical bills. How do you have medical bills if the doctor is not allowed to charge? What are you talking about? The Gemara even has a line that says, a doctor who heals for free is worthless. That's a line in the Gemara. So what do you make of this? So there are a couple of different resolutions. One resolution is what you see in number 7 in the rest of the line in the Shulchan Aruch. Schar ha-tarach v'habatala. A doctor is allowed to charge for tircha, for effort, for strain that is involved in doing the work. What constitutes strain in doing the work? Rabbi Chil Michal Epstein, writing in the beginning of the 20th century in Lithuania, said writing a prescription is strenuous. He didn't say reading the prescription is strenuous. He said writing the prescription is strenuous. I don't know what it was like in Novarduk in the beginning of the 20th century. I don't know if he was making his own paper. But that too counts as tircha. He can charge for the strain involved. And then the more relevant one is schar batala. Schar batala means wages for them to not engage in other revenue-bringing pursuits in order to devote their time to this pursuit, to the mitzvah pursuit. In other words, the doctor will say, I could have made a lot more money doing something else, or not even a lot more, it doesn't matter. I could have made a living doing something else. I chose not to do that, but instead I'm devoting my life to medicine. I need to be compensated so that I'm able to do that. That's called schar batala, for him to say, I'm gonna take payment in order to be able to devote myself to medicine. And these are sort of one school of thought, that a physician is not supposed to take payment in general. However, they can take payment for the strain involved in doing their mitzvah, and they could take payment as well for the fact that they're doing this and not making money in some other way. The other school of thought on this is to say it's not about the physician, the medical professional, saying, I'm going to say this is what society has to pay me in order for me to be a doctor. But rather, it's the other way. It's society saying, we are going to pay a certain amount because we want to make sure we have doctors. Because if word got out that doctors have to do this for free, how many doctors do you think you'd have? Not too many, right? I think. I think that's a fair statement. The reality is that the community is able to say, we feel this is necessary for the good of the community, and therefore we are going to pay. So I think that applies here as well. It will be wonderful and consistent with the value of the mitzvah involved for rabbis to certify products free of charge. But it's just not realistic for kashrus any more than it is for medicine. The amount of knowledge that goes into certifying a product, the work of actually going there, interviewing people, supervising, setting up systems to make sure that mistakes don't happen, and so forth. Yeah, not to mention answering questions from the public, but just the most basic work of supervision is expensive. We need people who are going to forego other types of income and devote themselves to this, and so we have the element of schar batala. We have the need to pay them, to compensate them, so that they will devote themselves to kashrus, and therefore it is appropriate for them to charge. I brought you a quote from Rabbi Yeshua Neuwirth, who's the author of Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasai, passed away a few years ago. Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avram quotes him in source number 9. He's talking about somebody about the question of whether a doctor can be compelled to see a patient free of charge. And Rav Neuwirth said that's nonsense. He says, what would be when a man trusts only a certain doctor, although other doctors would treat for free? He only wants the doctor who takes a fee. He says, I want that one, and he's going to have to be the one who's going to treat me for free. Well, we force the doctor to treat for free? Clearly you can't do that. So if the government offers a tax break, I see no reason why the VAD would not be able to accept it. The only caveat I would offer is, what if the VAD doesn't need the money in order to pay schar batala? Right? What if you have a VAD that has those revenue streams that were mentioned there, and it doesn't need the tax break? Or it doesn't need that much of a fee. If they're being paid as schar batala, then the answer has to be no. We make what we need to make, and we're done. Nonprofits usually don't work that way, but it's theoretically possible. I mean, generally speaking, nonprofits have a long list of things they would do if they had more income. And so whatever it is that comes in is then going to go out. That's the normal way these things work. Also, remember, we have that second element. Besides schar batala, schar tircha, besides those types of payment, you also have what the community says we want to pay in order to make sure that there will be such an institution. So that's as far as question one goes. I think they're able to take the payment, they're able to take the tax breaks. No, it should not be something over and above. It should be enough to be able to do the job that they do. But let's turn to the other two questions. The other two questions, to refresh your memory, because it was already 50 minutes ago, they are whether they can decline to certify food at an event for non-kashrus reasons, and whether they're allowed to certify products that don't actually require kosher supervision. I should note within that question, I'm not taking a stand on any individual product. I realize I already have taken a stand by mentioning before bathroom cleaner and water. Forgive me, please, if you have something to challenge on that, by all means. But these are two very, very important questions. Unlike the first question, which I think, again, relies on a lot of misinformation, I think these are more substantive. And from my standpoint, the way to approach these questions is by asking a bigger question, which is a VAD entitled to take payment for what is a VAD's role in the community? Is really the question that one needs to ask. By the way, I've been using a word sort of in and out. I want to make sure that I translate it. Not everyone is familiar. The term VAD, right? VAD HaKashrus is the organization that is responsible for kosher supervision. Okay. So, what exactly is the role of a VAD in the community? I think there are two ways you can look at it, and they're not mutually exclusive. Approach number one is that a VOD is a private organization enabling the community's mitzvah of observing kashrus. They are the people who have taken it upon themselves to make sure that I will have kosher food. That's one way to look at them. A model for this would be like a mohel, right? A mohel comes in, gets proper training, and sets up shop as somebody who is enabling those who have baby boys to fulfill the mitzvah of bris milah. Or a beis din. You have a rabbinical court, so they gain the training that's needed, they hang out the shingle, and they are available as the beis din that people can come to in order to follow the laws when they have issues between one party and another. That's one way that you can look at it. The other approach is to say that a VOD is more than that. The VOD is not just a private organization that enables the community's mitzvah. The VOD is a representative of halacha with a capital H. They are representatives of halacha. The parallel to that would be what's called in the Gemara an Adam Chashuv. Somebody of stature. Somebody of standing who represents Torah within the community. It would be a posek. Somebody who is a significant halachic authority. Sometimes the dayan, the judge on a beis din. Why does this distinction matter? I'll show you. If I take the first approach, the approach that they are a private organization that is making sure that kosher food is going to be available for people, then ask yourself the entertainment question. Are they allowed to decline to help others with their mitzvah because of separate halachic issues? Their role is make sure there's going to be kosher food. How does entertainment figure into that? On the one hand, you'd say, normally, a mohel is not allowed to decline an opportunity to give a bris. Somebody comes to the mohel and says, I had a baby boy, I need the bris done. Mohel's not allowed to say no. What if the mohel then is going to go broke because the mohel is not going to be paid? Based in it, the community can look into making sure that the mohel is compensated. But the mohel is not allowed to say no. If anybody's interested, I have responses on the topic we could talk about later. However, we do have precedent, and it's in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, for a mohel, in fact, declining under certain circumstances to provide a bris. If you take a look at source number 10 and number 11, that's where I brought it for you. In the interest of time, I'm going to tell you outside what you can see on the page yourself. In number 10, it's talking about a person who refuses to comply with a decree of the beis din, with a decree of a rabbinical court. In source number 11, it's talking about a man who refuses to divorce his wife when the rabbinical court has decreed that he is required to do so. And in both of those cases, among the penalties is that indeed they won't give his sons a bris milah. Sons won't have a bris. This actually came up, by the way, not that long ago. There was a whole story out of Israel. I never heard the bottom line on what the story was, but there was a man who was refusing to give his wife a get, and there was a decree from the Beis Din there that when his mother passed away, they wouldn't bury her. Right? Have people read about this at the time? I don't remember what the final story was and what the truth of the matter was, because there was a lot of back and forth in the press about what was going on, but that's an implementation of what you're seeing here in number 11. So, what this means is, there is indeed the possibility for a mohel to say no where somebody is engaged in impropriety, and therefore you can make the argument that a VOD as well is able to say no. We are private certifiers, and we believe that that this is important for community standards. It really should come like it does here at a Beis Din's order, as opposed to the VOD's own statement. It should really come from the Beis Din saying, "Don't give the kid a bris. Don't certify their food." But I think that's fair. What about giving an unnecessary certification? So if I take the model again that they're just providing kosher food for people, then they probably can do this. They're allowed to put their stamp on bottled water. They're allowed to put their stamp on bathroom cleaner because they're just a private organization. They may have benefits that come to them because the government chose to, but they're a private organization. They have to act ethically. Meaning, if someone asks them, is there a difference between this one and this one? If someone asks them, does bathroom cleaner require hashgacha? Their answer has to be honest. If the business says to them, does this product require it? They have to be honest and say, no, it doesn't require it at all. If the business says, yeah, but we think that this will be good advertising for us, that's the business's business, so to speak, and they would be entitled to accept it under that first model. But let's go to the second model now. The second model says they are representatives of halacha. That status introduces halachic obligations for the Beis Din, for the God, excuse me, regarding their professional and personal conduct and its impact on the community. I brought you an example of this in source number 12, the Gemara in Gittin. The Gemara there is talking about delivering a get, a bill of divorce. There are issues that come up when delivering a get from one country to another in terms of making sure that the people at the destination country are comfortable that everything was done properly in the source country. And so there have been rules down through the ages of witnesses who deliver the get testifying about how the get was written. Well, the story here at number 12, the passage in the Talmud, was there's a fellow by the name of Bar Hedya who wanted to be approved to deliver Gittin. He wanted to deliver the bill of divorce. He came to Rabbi Achi, the official responsible for Gittin, who said to him, you have to be present when every letter is written, which is not the requirement. But that's what he was told. He then came to Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, who told him, you need not do so. There's no such requirement that you have to be present when every letter is written. And if you're going to say, I'm going to be strict, you will slander earlier Gittin. People are going to think that this is now a requirement, that this is the way that it's supposed to be done. People are going to hear this and think that everybody else has been doing it wrong regarding Gittin. You're not allowed to create a practice, in this case a chumrah, a stringency, which is going to mislead others. This can involve technical violations, lifnei iver, not to cause people to stumble. And it can also create expenditures on behalf of the community. Rabbis historically have had a strong concern for limiting what people need to spend in order to do a mitzvah. There's a classic story, the Tzemach Tzedek Krachmal, the first Tzemach Tzedek, had this story happen where people in his community were faced with a problem because of the fish merchants. The fish merchants were raising the price of fish on Fridays, knowing that Jews were buying fish for Shabbos. So what did he do? I saw a couple of heads nodding here. You know what they did? He banned fish for Shabbos. No gefilte fish. Drives the price down, and now people are able to afford fish again. But first they have to go some period of time without fish for Shabbos, because it was important that people not be paying exorbitant fees in order to be able to afford gefilte fish for Shabbos. This goes back to the Gemara. This wasn't the Tzemach Tzedek's innovation. This idea goes back to the Gemara. It's a longer discussion than I'm going to have time for in my part of the presentation. But we have a concern. If the agent of halacha in the community is going to do something that can create a stringency, it's going to cause people to think that others are doing it wrong, and it's going to cause other people to, and it's going to cause people to spend more. Now we have something of a problem. In addition, there's a separate concern. If you are an agent of halacha, capital H, you have to make sure that your conduct is so above board that nobody is going to think that you are engaged in misconduct. And that's a very serious requirement. I brought you the Gemara in source number 13. There's no time for us to go through it right now, but you can see it there, those who wish to see it. It's in 15 as well. 15 is good. Rav Huna said, in Usha, it's short, they enacted that if a chief justice goes bad, we don't excommunicate him. We tell him, be honored and remain at home. We don't want you engaged in this. You give halacha a bad name. You give the Beis Din a bad name. If he keeps on going, then we would indeed excommunicate him, because we are concerned about bringing halacha into discredit. So that's also a concern here. So let's apply that to questions 2 and 3. The entertainment issue. So I think then, if they are representatives of halacha, I think they may be obligated to turn down certification here. Meaning, if you just say they're a private agency that makes kosher food available, then if a Beis Din says don't certify them, then don't certify them. But if they represent halacha, how can they be involved with a business entity that is providing something that halacha rejects? I'm struggling to come up with a phrase. You're in bed with an organization that you shouldn't be in bed with. That's a very real concern. On the other hand, the third question, the unnecessary certification issue, they may indeed be obligated to turn down that opportunity to certify the product, lest it lead people to think it's obligatory, or lest it lead people to lose respect for that which they represent, or lest it narrow people's product choices so that they end up spending more money. So the upshot for me is the following. Regarding question two, the issue of the glatyat, the entertainment, I think that they may indeed pull the certification if they are viewed as a private entity that provides kosher food, and if they represent halacha, then I think they may be obligated to do so. In terms of the third question, certifying a product that doesn't need certification, so if they are an enabler of the community's mitzvahs, making kosher food available, then I think they may certify as long as they state up front to the business, to everybody. You know, anybody who asks has to know this isn't this hashgacha is not required. But if they're viewed as an adam chashuv, and I'm not weighing in on which approach it is. I think both approaches can be defended. So I'm not posking anyway, but I'm certainly not posking on which approach to use here. But if you take the second approach, that they are viewed as an Adam Chashuv, that they represent halacha, then I think there really is a problem with providing such a certification, although I think there is a way to mitigate it. And I think the way to mitigate it is to provide regular education for the public about what needs hashgacha and what does not need hashgacha. Whether that means via public programs, whether that means a page on the website saying the following foods don't require certification, I think that it can be mitigated. And to me, that would be an appropriate thing to do. So at this point, I'm going to cede the floor, having, I hope, addressed my three questions. I will remind people before Rabbi Heber gets up that Rabbi Bergman is available for questions to submit questions. He has cards and pencils if you want to write them down. But if you could, please make sure that you provide them to him during the program. We don't want to do a Q&A afterwards in which it's, you know, questions, you know, hands raised. We want to do it via submitted cards, if at all possible. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mori Barabosai, and Bershus, the Rosh Kollel, Rav Tarchiner, and Rav Sammy Bergman, and Kola Kola Kodesh Hazeh. It's a tremendous privilege, a pleasure, and a real honor to share the podium with Rabbi Tarchiner. As he mentioned when he started the drasha, if you came in a little bit late, I'll repeat it. We've had a connection with the YU Kollel at the COR for many, many years. We've been involved in joint programming. We've taken the Avreichim to all sorts of establishments at the COR. And while we hope they benefit from the experience, certainly we at the COR have benefited from being able to show and to be transparent and to have real Talmidei Chachamim join us in our endeavors. And we're grateful to Rabbi Tarchiner and his Kollel for that opportunity. I want to just begin by adding a couple of quick points. First of all, I love the fish story when they ossered the fish. Can somebody please ask the Rabbanim to do that for a Sreigim? They should do that. They should do that. It's been done. Yeah, I heard the Ger Rebbe once did that. He told all of the tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of Hasidim, everybody's got to share one Esrig for Sukkot. I want to add a couple of points. Number one is on question number one from Rabbi Tarchiner about the governmental oversight of kashrus agencies. I can tell you from first-hand experience that there's an incredible amount of oversight. COR specifically is audited almost every quarter. And Baruch Hashem, for the sake of transparency and being able to come out credibly, the government does hone down on these organizations, and Baruch Hashem, organizations are very proud to share and to be transparent, and everything is Baruch Hashem on the up and up. There are two streams of revenue, we'll call it. One is from industrial kashrus and one is from food service, which is community kashrus. So industrial kashrus does make money. In fact, in the States, you have many kashrus organizations which are not charities. They're not non-for-profits, they're for-profits, openly for-profit businesses. And industrial kashrus does make money. So similar to the Moel example. But food service kashrus, as Rabbi Torchiner experienced in Allentown, does not make any money. In fact, it loses a lot of money. And if you're a good, solid, effective hashgacha doing food service kashrus, which is a function of labor that you provide, in my personal philosophy, I don't know if all kashrus organizations share it, and I don't even know if the leaders at COR share it. My personal philosophy is that the more hashgacha, the more labor, the more supervision, the better. And that means if we did have some extra money at the end of the year, we would hire another mashgiach. We'd hire another senior mashgiach. We'd send people more often into establishments to be able to supervise them properly. And a good, responsible, effective kashrus organization loses money, and a significant amount of money, in the food service. So Baruch Hashem, we in Toronto are privileged to have an organization like COR that, on the one hand, can combine industrial kashrus, which does bring in revenue, and spend that money in the food services, being able to provide the community with a top level of supervision and certification. Now I'm going to go to my questions, which are, the first question. Years ago, commercial kashrus agencies certified businesses which were open on Shabbos. Now, many refuse to do so. What has changed? The second question, should a certifier implement the lowest common denominator or elevated standard of kashrus or multiple standards? You find mahadrins, not mahadrins in different cities. In Eretz Yisrael you have a lot of that. And the third question is, should a commercial kashrus certifier refuse to have certain vegetables at their events because infestation is high? And I'll tell you, that's my personal favorite question. And I'll get there, hopefully. Okay, let's talk a little bit about businesses which are open on Shabbos. So the question assumes that it used to be that businesses were open on Shabbos, and nowadays, that's less so. So I wasn't so sure that was true. That it used to be that they were, and now that's less so. We all know businesses, we're all very familiar with kashrus businesses, caterers that are open on Shabbos. In fact, almost every shul in the city has a kashrus business that's open on Shabbos in their catering kitchen. So there are businesses, nursing homes are open on Shabbos. We do a lot of supervision on Shabbos. I think the biggest problem of businesses being open on Shabbos is how can COR pay their mashgichim? Isn't it Schar Shabbos? How can they even take wages for working on Shabbos? That's probably the biggest question. But there are many catering facilities, there are many operations that are open on Shabbos. In fact, and I want to differentiate, there are large cities out there in North America and Eretz Yisrael that even have restaurants open on Shabbos. But here's where we have to make a differentiation. Catering facilities and restaurants that can convert themselves into catering facilities like you have in Florida and California and Eretz Yisrael, where you pay before Shabbos, and you order the food, and they prepare everything before Shabbos, and Shabbos is all about service, so there's nothing halakhically wrong with that. There's no problem with that at all. And if a restaurant converted itself into, managed to convert itself into such a catering facility, there would be no halakhic problem with doing so. I think the question is really, can a restaurant or a bakery be open on Shabbos? And that is not uncommon in small towns. There's a town in Pennsylvania, not Allentown, different town in Pennsylvania that has a bakery that's open through the week, 7 days a week on Shabbos, and the local Rav, the Rav of the city, does give hashgacha to that bakery. So it is open on Shabbos, and they're selling, and they're baking on Shabbos. And there are Dunkin' Donuts. I use that example. There's probably other things like Second Cups or the equivalent of that in the States, whatever it is, that are open on Shabbos. So is that okay? Was that common, and is that less common now, is the question. So I did a little bit of research, and that's point number one. And I found that the New York Times Diner's Journal, that speaks a lot about food. So I wanted to see what the Hamoin Am, what the people out there thought about this question. And the writer, Fred Bernstein, said, "I was surprised that you described the Second Avenue Deli as kosher, because it's open on the Sabbath. Almost no observant Jew would consider it kosher. Believe it or not," Fred added, "I had this very conversation last Thursday with none other than Steven Spielberg, Sacha Baron Cohen, and Leah Adler, who's Steven Spielberg's mother, at her kosher dairy restaurant in L.A. In a subsequent email, Fred specified that Sacha Baron Cohen and Leah Adler, both whom keep kosher, said that the restaurant that's open on Sabbath isn't kosher. So there is a feeling out there amongst the Hamon Am, we'll call it, the communities at large, that if a restaurant is open on Shabbos, it can't be considered kosher. And rightly so. Isn't the restaurant violating the principles of Shabbos? They're selling on Shabbos. They're cooking on Shabbos. They're baking on Shabbos. How could that be considered kosher?" Interestingly enough, and this is point number two, the Kovetz Shuvos was written by Rav Yosef Shalom Elyashiv in volume 3 in the third Stimon. This goes back to 1963. The question was posed. B'dover HaShela, and the question was asked, that there was a restaurant in Munich, it was actually a fish restaurant, that was owned by a Jew and was open on Shabbos and Yom Tov. So the Jewish person who owned the restaurant did not walk into the restaurant on Shabbos and Yom Tov. In fact, he just had a non-Jewish person running the restaurant, and they were preparing everything on Yom Tov and Shabbos. And the non-Jewish restaurant would take a percentage of all the monthly profits, and he would keep that as his schar, as his wage for taking a little bit of an ownership role in running the restaurant. Everybody in Munich knew that this restaurant was owned by a Jew. And they asked Rabbi Yashiv in 1963, "Is this okay? Or is it not okay?" So Rabbi Yashiv describes the halachic principles involved. And in this particular situation, the non-Jewish person who is running the restaurant has the halachic status of an aris. An aris is a sharecropper. And the old example that the Talmud brings, the Gemara brings, is where a sharecropper used to run a business on somebody else's field. So somebody owned a lot of property, but he wasn't a farmer. So he hired a farmer to work the field. And they split the revenues. The shlish, the matzah, the revia, the Gemara says, different types of percentages depending on the situation. Perhaps a more contemporary example is in the hotel business, where you have individuals who own hotels, and you have companies like the Trump Organization, that run the management of the hotel for the owner. And you have that in many cases. We've had that experience, we've seen that at the Four Seasons, at the Trump Hotel downtown. That is the case. So you have one entity, one corporate entity that's the ownership, that represents the ownership, and you have the other entity, which is the manager that is running the actual business. And in halacha, that's called an aris. Now an aris, a sharecropper literally, he has full say. They hire, they fire, they have full say on the management and how that business operates. And therefore the question was, in this particular situation with the restaurant in Munich, is that non-Jewish person an aris? And is an aris allowed to work a restaurant on Shabbos? So Rabbi Yashiv argues that even though the aris, the sharecropper, is running his own business, and in this case, this executive chef, this non-Jew, he's actually running this business, he's hiring and he's firing and he's paying the employees, etc. And the Jewish owner may have been less involved. He seemed to be an investor. And he owned the structure called the restaurant, but he wasn't actually running the business day to day. So in that case, maybe the non-Jew who's running the business on Shabbos is allowed to continue on Shabbos. He's allowed to continue on Shabbos and Yom Tov. Why? Because he's not Jewish. So if he's not Jewish, what's wrong? What's wrong if he's not Jewish? If the ownership, if the management of the establishment is not Jewish, then what's wrong with running the restaurant on Shabbos? So Rabbi Yashu says, no, you're not allowed to. And why? Because of Maris Ayin. There are certain types of businesses, like fields, that you can send a sharecropper to run the business on Shabbos, and there's no Maris Ayin because everybody understands that this business is being run by another independent non-Jewish company that's running the field, that's operating the field on Shabbos. But there are other sorts of businesses. The Gemara's example is Amerikats. That's what they used to have. People didn't have bathhouses in their own homes, so they had to go to a bathhouse, and the bathhouse were businesses. And they used to take money and used to go in, kind of like a health club, and go in and do your thing in the bathhouse. So those types of businesses, the halacha is that you're not allowed to run those businesses through a sharecropper on Shabbos and Yom Tov. And the reason is because since it's not normal to have this divided ownership structure where you have one entity owning the business and the other entity owning the management of the business, it's not normal. Normally you just hire a person to run that business. Therefore, there's Maris Ayin. People are going to think that there is no separate entity running the business, and therefore you, as the Jewish person, is actually running a business on Shabbos. And therefore, Rabbi Yashu said that in that particular situation, it's not allowed. Where would it be allowed? It would be allowed if it's independent, non-Jewish, if there's an independent non-Jewish ownership, or even a non-Jewish partnership with a Jewish entity. In those types of situations, it could technically be allowed, al pi halacha. So you could have a Dunkin' Donuts that's open on Shabbos, that's running the business on Shabbos, if the owner or the franchisee was not Jewish. That would be allowed according to halacha. What's the challenge for a kashrus organization? The challenge would be how to supervise such a business on Shabbos. How would you send a mashgiach? How would you send a mashgiach to supervise such a business on Shabbos? So it could be that in certain scenarios or situations, there's no major risk, because maybe they're getting the same types of foods all the time. They have to get certain menu items, like in these kinds of franchise stores, and there's no real concern that they're going to get something else to replace it. There are certain scenarios where one can imagine that would be okay, and that you wouldn't actually need hashgach on Shabbos. So perhaps it's in the neighborhood, and you could provide a certain amount of supervision on Shabbos. That's a possibility as well. So it can technically be done. You have certain scenarios, and that's the Dunkin' Donuts scenario that you see in communities in the States. That's the bakery scenario in small towns where they're supervising on Shabbos. Why do larger cities shy away and stronger vadim shy away from this? First of all, there's not that much. There aren't, in my experience, there have been a couple of times where people have come forward and said, can we have a business on Shabbos? And that's open on Shabbos. That's mainly because the malls in general, in Toronto for sure, but probably around the world, actually have a rule that you can't open a business if you're going to shut it on Shabbos. You can't close your business on Shabbos if they're going to lose that revenue. So sometimes you have a proprietor who wants to open up a business in a mall, and he's not able to open a kosher business in a mall because he's going to have to be closed on Shabbos if that's what the VAD's policy is. So that can pose a problem. But the in general, the Vadim do shy away. It's true. They do shy away from wanting to do this. And for a practical person, not because it's Asr al-Pi Din, because as we explained, it is Mutar al-Pi Din, as long as it's a non-Jewish owner. I have a very funny story of an establishment that once approached us, and there was a non-Jewish owner. He wanted to open up a business in a mall. And we were explaining to him, okay, you know, it'll be a challenge. Shabbos, Yom Tov, we have to go to our Vad HaRabbanim and discuss, are they willing to do this? We don't know. We don't have a precedent here in Toronto to do such a thing. Fine. In the middle of the conversation, we're talking and talking and talking, and I ask him where he's from, and he tells me, well, he's from this and this place. Well, do you know any Jewish people? Yeah, in fact, I had one grandmother who was Jewish. Which grandmother is Jewish? Oh, my mother's mother. You're Jewish. Conversation ended right there, and we said, you can't open on Shabbos. I mean, that's for sure. You're Jewish. You can't open on Shabbos. So these are the challenges. Why do Vadim not want to allow this? Because there may be an increase of Chilul Shabbos. It may be a Chilul Hashem. Because Jewish people, it depends on the situation. You can't generalize for everything, but there may be people who are frequenting establishments on Shabbos and are driving to them because of this. So it is a shikul hadas. You do need the Adam Chashuv aspect, which is represented in the Vad HaRabbanim that we have, that understands the challenges and is willing to weigh the situation and then act accordingly. And if it's okay alpidin, which it is, and if it fits within the hashkafa of what should be considered a kiddush Hashem as opposed to a chilul Hashem, they'll do it. I don't know if any of you know this, but there is an establishment that's under COR that's open on Shabbos as a restaurant. No, that's a caterer. No, Zaks is not open on Shabbos. There's an establishment called the WA Cafe in Baycrest that's open on Shabbos, and they operate business on Shabbos. And they prepare most things before Shabbos, but coffee is made on Shabbos, and they sell on Shabbos. And if you're wondering what the reason is because Baycrest largely is built to serve its constituency, which is mostly the employees of Baycrest, mostly non-Jewish, and you can't have a scenario, or they feel so, that they don't have food service on Shabbos. And the ownership of the entity that runs the WA Cafe has a non-Jewish partnership. And therefore, there's no issues of operating a business on Shabbos. Next question is, should a certifier implement the lowest common denominator, elevated standard, or multiple standards? Mahajan, not Mahajan, what's the story with this? So, I like this question very much, because I believe that there is a misunderstanding in what Mahajan versus non-Mahajan is. Mahajan, not Mahajan, standards, different standards. I believe that a Rav, if you have a Rav, you have a Rabbi, you go to him with a Shaila, he paskins a Shaila according to the way he understands, according to what his Rebbeim have taught him, and that's the psak you accept because you have that Rabbi for you. It might be a Chumrah in one situation, it might be a Kula in a different situation. But that's the way that our people have operated since the beginning of time, since Matan Torah. That's what it is. So higher standards versus lower standards is not really the difference between Mahajan and non-Mahajan. Yes, it's true that Mahajan Hashgachas try to lean towards the higher standard and not the lower standard, it's true. But I can give you countless examples where Mahajan Hashgachas are very, very makel with very questionable Piskei Dinim. I don't know if I can give you examples of lower standards of Ashkacha that are Machmer, but definitely the other way around. So, what's the story? What is really different? And I really, really liked, in point number three, Rabbi Eliezer Melamed, who wrote an article on Arutz Sheva on their website, and said the following point, which I believe really captures it, and I've always felt that this is true. And yet, the difference between standard and Mahajan Kashrut is clearly expressed first and foremost in the level of supervision. Standard Kashrut suffices with occasional supervision suitable in accordance with the rules of Halacha. While Mahajan Kashrut supervision is closer and stricter, thereby reducing mishaps which are liable to occur. So that's exactly right. The difference between less Mahajan, more Mahajan, or if a Vat is struggling with this, should we be Mahajan, should we not Mahajan, should we provide two Hashgachas? The difference is a function of how closely are you supervising the establishment? How well are you built? What's your structure, what's your organizational structure like? Does it look like the OU? With senior management, with rabbinical supervisors, with rabbinical field mashgichim that go out to all different establishments, there's multi-layers within the organization? Or is it just an individual that's kind of giving hashgacha? That's the difference between regular and mahajan, if that's what you want to call it. It doesn't matter what the organization calls itself. It matters how they're built and how they're supervising. And it is very true that a Mahajan Hashgacha has a chiyuv, has an obligation to supervise in this way, closer and stricter, thereby reducing mishaps that are liable to occur. And that's really the difference. OU has a policy that they have to have in every restaurant a Mashgiach Tamidi. In Toronto, that wouldn't be feasible at all, because restaurants would just go out of business. If every restaurant had to have a Mashgiach Tamidi, it would be impossible. But, Mashgiach Tamidi means a full-time supervisor. Mashgiach Tamidi. There are different levels of Tamidi also. You know, it says that the menorah was lit from the morning to the evening. Right? It's a ner tamid. It was a ner tamid. So Pampa Boker and Pampa Erev might also be considered a Mashgiach Tamidi, a full-time supervisor. It's unclear, but full-time supervision from when you open the establishment, you open the fridges, till you lock the establishment, till you lock the fridges, that's a Mahajan Hashgacha. And if you're visiting less, and if you're less on top of the establishment, then you're not Mahajan Hashgacha. That's the difference between the levels of supervision. Let's go to Shulchan Aruch. That's point number 4, Yeridei Simin 118, Kuf Yud Ches, Tif Aleph. I'm not going to read through the whole thing. You can see it there. But basically, the Shulchan Aruch advises that at a very minimum, you are allowed to leave a non-Jewish person in your house or in your restaurant alone, as long as he doesn't know when you're coming in and he doesn't lock the door. If he locks the door and you're not able to come in, the food is not kosher. Open sif in Shulchan Aruch. But if he's allowing you to come in and you can come at any time you want, even if you're not there constantly, and even if you're not there all the time and you're away for extended periods of time, that is still okay. And the reason it's still okay is because you've created what's called in halakha terminology a mirsas. A mirsas means a fear. There is a fear amongst the non-Jewish people who are working there, the people who are not. They don't know when you're going to come, and therefore you've established a mirsas, a fear. And therefore the food can still be considered kosher. So even if you do it that way, even if you're just in and out, by the way, the Hebrew terminology for this type of hashgacha is called yotze v'nichnas. It's not in and out. Yotze v'nichnas means out and in, which means you're in, sometimes you go out. You're out and in, but you're in. It's not nichnas v'yotze, that's you're out, but sometimes you go in. No, you're in, but sometimes you go out. And here's where it gets a little bit tricky. What is the minimum level of supervision when it comes to this? It's very interesting. If you look at point number 5, so we all know that the Chalav Yisrael production is a very intense amount of supervision. You actually have to have a Mashgiach Tamidi, this full-time supervision. And the Mashgiach has to be in that plant that's producing the milk and that's milking the cows on the farm, and he has to be able to be, he doesn't have to be seeing the cows milked, but he has to be in a position where if he would stand up, he would be able to see. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says, that he has to be in a position that if he would stand up, he would be able to see it. The Turei Zav in number 6, commenting on that, says that the hashgacha, the supervision level of yotzei v'nichnas, of out and in, is actually superior to the mashgiach at the milk factory. Which means that the mashgiach in the milk factory is sitting outside the door. It's true, if he stand up, he could look in and see the cows being milked, and not a non-kosher animal, for example. But the yotzei v'nichnas would actually go in sometimes. So that's a superior type of supervision to the mashgiach who is sitting outside the farm and could stand up and see right into the farm. Which means that the yotzei v'nichnas supervision has to be at the level where it's superior to the mashgiach who's standing at the farm. And the Igros Moshe in point number 7 in Yerideah volume 3, Simon 8 actually says, you know, this is a tremendous mishkal, it's a tremendous stumbling block that's out there. Because sometimes mashgichim are away from establishments very, very often. And they rarely come in. And the ownership and the management and the chefs that are working inside the establishments are very much aware of that. And they're not mirsas. They're not afraid anymore. And since they're not afraid anymore, you lose the effectiveness of the hashgacha. So it is true that there's a minimum level of hashgacha called yotzei v'nichnas. And the more intense your supervision is, the more mahajran you are, and the more built your organization is, the more mahajran you are, the more levels, the more people coming in and out of the establishment, the better you are. But we have to also remember that even the minimum standard has to be very, very carefully watched. So in terms of the question, if we're going to go back to the question, we're going to ask, should the certifier implement lowest common denominator or elevated standard or multiple standards? I think the question's a bit of a misnomer. If we're talking about kulos, which are leniencies, and chumras, which are stringencies, the organization should implement the stringencies that the rabbanim of the organization wish to implement. And the leniency should be implemented as per the wish of the rabbanim, especially in a community kashrus organization. Because that's we submit to the daya, to the opinion of our rabbanim. But if we're talking about, and this is really true out there in the world, where you have less reliable or less mahadrin hashgachas, okay, and it doesn't mean the one that's not called mahadrin, but you have to find out, you have to do your research, where the supervision is at a level where it doesn't even qualify for yotzei v'nichnas, then you have a real problem at a minimum standard. And the more intense the supervision is, the better you are. So we as consumers have to be able to ask these questions from our own kashrus organizations, as well as kashrus organizations in the cities that we visit. These are the critical questions. How constant is your supervision? Finally, we'll conclude with the question of vegetables. And I'm skipping a couple of points because we don't have the time. But the vegetables, the question is, should a kosher organization refuse to have certain vegetables at their events because infestation is high? We have to know one thing. Infestation of vegetables is true. That's the first thing we have to realize. And we have to acknowledge. Not every vegetable. The truth is, any vegetable that grows in the ground can have infestation. But it's not common in many vegetables, but for the vegetables and the fruits, the produce that it is common in, we have to realize that even if we may not see it right away, those people who are experts in the field see it right away. I often compare this to the Where's Waldo book. You probably saw the video at the Siyum HaShas where there was a guy who was dressed up as Waldo. Right, and everybody was pointing, the cameras were zooming in. Somebody found him amongst the sea of 90,000 people. They found him. They found that they spotted him. He was spotted. Why don't you see Waldo right away when you're looking at that page in the book? Why don't you see him right away? Because he's camouflaged. There's two ways to see. You see with your eyes what's in front of you, and you see with your mind. Once you understand what it is you're looking for, you can see it much better. So once you've found Waldo once, you can see him very easily. So anybody who says to you, you know, the issue of insect infestation is untrue because the bugs are so minuscule you can't even see them, they're not nira la'ayin lo nidna Torah l'machi asharis, which means they're not visible to the naked eye, and the Torah wasn't given to the angels above, that's not the case. It's just not the case. It's like telling the doctor, you know, you saw it in the x-ray, but it just doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. I'm sorry. How do you know? You're not an expert. You don't know what I see. I see something that you don't see. I can teach you how to see it if you spend long enough, but you may not see it right away. So that's the first point that I believe is very important. You need expertise. You need a kashrus organization. You need community people like the Mohel who are trained in this to be able to see, to understand, and to teach the community about what is actually going on. But it is not the correct way, and this we have received instruction from our rabbis, to forbid everything that comes out just because there is an existence of infestation. First of all, those kashrus organizations out there in the world who went and said that anything that is infested should not be looked at, they lack a very large amount of expertise. Also, for the simple fact that they've never had the practice. If you usher something, if you forbid it, then you don't have the practice of actually dealing with it and working with it. So it's a very, very, very important for a kashrus agency to be able to take on an issue like insect infestation head on and understand it. Largely, the vegetables that you all miss from the old days, like broccoli, fresh broccoli, those kinds of vegetables, the reason why an organization like the COR and other organizations out there, I'm not speaking tonight for the COR, but organizations out there that don't do certain vegetables, it's economics. It's not because of Isser Veheter. It's because it's so expensive to wash and check that head of broccoli that it's just not worth it. In New York, maybe it's worth the money to check and to spend time and to have a mashgiach who's working at X amount of dollars an hour work a couple of hours on your head of broccoli. That might be worth it in New York. But here in Toronto, it's not a real restaurant town. So it's just not economical when it comes to certain vegetables. But I can tell you, a fruit like a strawberry, for example, is something that is significantly heavily infested with insects. And yet we still allow it under the hashgacha of the COR. And I'm going to explain to you very quickly, because I know the time is short, I'm going to explain to you why the approach to insect infestation from the Isser Veheter, from the halachic perspective, is not to say that things are forbidden. And the question is, we know that in the Shechita department, after they shecht an animal, after they slaughter the animal, they check the lungs to see if there's any lesions on the lungs which would represent a treifa, a non-kosher animal. Because usually that means a sircha, a lesion, usually that means that there's a hole in the lung and therefore the animal is a treifa and it cannot be considered kosher. The question is, and this is point number 9, is what happens if you open up the animal and a dog come and steal the lungs? What do you do at that point? You can't check it anymore. Do you say the animal is non-kosher? No. The animal is still kosher. Harezu muteres. This animal is permitted. Why? Because even though there is an obligation to check, still, if I can't check, in absence of the ability to check, I can assume that the animal is kosher and it doesn't have those problems, those treifas, because most animals don't have problems. And therefore I can rely on Rove, on the majority of animals which don't have those problems, to allow that animal. Why do we check the lungs? So the most common reasoning that's provided in the poskim to explain why we check the lungs and we don't check any other limb of the animal, any other artery of the animal, to see if maybe there's a problem. Why not? There could be a problem in any part of the animal. Why do we check only the lungs? Because the lungs are common to have a problem. So if something's common to have a problem, you have to check it. And if something's not common to have a problem, you don't have to check it. You can assume there's no problem. And the same principles apply to insect infestation of vegetables. If there's a vegetable that's commonly infested, you have to check it. But if it's not common to have infestation, you don't have to check it. But we already saw from the halacha that if the dog steals it and you can't check it anymore, then you can assume it's permitted. There's a Rashba, and this is my last point, in Chulin, that gives another reason why we check the lungs versus any other part of the animal. And that is because even though the lungs are common, you wouldn't really have to check them. You could rely on the majority. But if you don't check them, it appears as if you're being malim ayin me'isr, which means you're ignoring the possibility of isr, of a problem. You can't ignore. You must do your best. And therefore, and I'll conclude with this, if I am able, if I have the ability to actually check, and it's not that I'm being malim ayin me'isr, I'm not hiding my eyes from the isr, I have to check. But if I can't check, if something's impossible to check, then I'm allowed to use it after I've done my best. And that's really the philosophy that we use when it comes to insects, infestation of vegetables and produce that have a tremendous amount of infestation. We don't simply forbid produce. What we do is we try our best. We gain as much expertise as we possibly can to make sure that the fruit or the vegetable is completely clean of insect infestation. But at the end of the day, once we do our best, but we're worried, maybe we don't have enough, maybe we haven't done enough, there's halachic grounds to say that that is okay. As long as you've done your best, you've gained expertise, you've learned how to check, you've learned how to wash, and you've done what you think should work, and what does work most of the time, you don't have to say, well, because I know that sometimes it may not work, therefore it's usr, therefore it's forbidden. You can actually allow it in such a situation. And that concludes my portion of the night.
So we, first of all, thank you again, Rabbi Heber, and thank you everybody for being here. We have three cards that were submitted. I've got two, and Rabbi Heber has one as well. So the first one is a comment, and I just want to read it to acknowledge it because it is indeed true. That wasn't submitted. Okay, Rabbi Bergman, can you just get the one that was over there? It's a comment. It is not only Orthodox Jews who benefit from kosher products. Many conservative and other Jews do as well, as do non-Jews, such as Christians, Muslims, vegetarians. I don't think those are mutually exclusive. So it really is a public service. Absolutely true. There just are a lot of people out there who don't, you know, go looking for kosher food. But it's certainly true that it appeals beyond the Jewish community. And then a question that was submitted for me, I'm assuming it was for me. How does a kosher organization reconcile providing a hechsher, supervising, products that do not require one, and declining certification to food at an event for non-kosher reasons like problematic entertainment, with item number 4 on the source sheet, which said about the COR, that its charity listing says, the charity promotes the observance of Orthodox Judaism by ensuring the availability and identification of kosher products through its supervision and certification of food service production. In other words, what the questioner is asking is, I made the point in the beginning when talking about taking the tax exemption that everything is on the up and up, and it's listed on the CRA website, and it describes exactly what the organization does. However, if you're talking about giving certification
certification to something that doesn't need it, or if you're talking about pulling certification because of entertainment, how is that consistent with what you're saying you do? Your job description is just that you provide supervision and certification of food. That's the question I was asked. So I think that you have two different aspects here. From the standpoint of the statement itself, everything is entirely consistent because it begins with the charity promotes the observance of Orthodox Judaism by ensuring availability and identification. And the fact of the matter is that the job of saying for the entertainment, I can't certify this if I also represent halacha, I think that's consistent. I think from that standpoint, that doesn't bother me so much. The idea that they're also certifying things that don't necessarily need it, that don't necessarily require it, I agree, troubles me more in terms of this line. But ultimately, it's the second way of looking at this line that really matters, which is the CRA side of things. Meaning, fundamentally, this is about satisfying the government's definition of advancement of religion. I can believe that this qualifies as advancing religion. The question is, does the CRA? I'm not looking to ask the CRA this question. In other words, to write the CRA a letter and say, well, our VAD, you know, supervises products. We also supervise things that don't necessarily require it. I think it's an interesting question. I'm not about to be the one to ask them that, but I understand where the question is coming from. That's basically where I would leave this. I think it's consistent with advancement of Orthodox Judaism. At the same time, I understand certainly what goes into the question. Rabbi Haber.
Just to comment on that, the key is transparency, and Rabbi Torshiner made that point when he spoke, and it's true that a bottle of water might get a hashgacha because the company wants it for marketing reasons or to promote their product, and they think that water with a hechsher actually should sell better than water without a hechsher. That might be true, but I think for the reason of transparency, the Vada Kashrus, as Rabbi Torshiner says, has to set up a hotline and answer questions honestly. So if somebody's asking, is this particular product, does it require a hechsher? And the Vada Kashrus says no, then they're not doing anything that is not legitimate, because they're answering the question. You don't have to buy that one with the COR, and there aren't going to be people who are going to think that you need hashgacha on water because of it, because they have a way to ask. The questions that I have are the issue of an allergen. I'm just going to summarize the question. There's an issue of an allergen. Sometimes products say may contain nuts, shellfish, dairy. Product is parv and kosher. It has a particular hashgacha. How could you say may contain shellfish? Does that make any sense? So I'll tell you, generally speaking, maybe this shouldn't be recorded, but generally speaking, no, it's okay. May contain actually means doesn't contain. May contain usually means it doesn't contain. The companies have this legal problem that if somebody would eat their product and say, I'm allergic to nuts, for example, and the company doesn't deal with nuts, but say, I got that reaction because of you, I'm going to sue you, the company doesn't need that lawsuit. And therefore, lots of companies list a tremendous amount of what's called in the industry allergens, things that it may contain in order to avoid that potential lawsuit. And therefore, they just list all sorts of items that are not in there. If there's dairy upstairs in the facility and downstairs there's no dairy, they will write. They will write may contain dairy. Even though halakhically it's 100% parv, there's no problem. You cook parv on one side of your kitchen and dairy on the other side of your kitchen. There's no problem of halakha with that. But the company will write may contain dairy. They always do. For overseas companies, how do you certify? That's a very, very good question. There's a wonderful, wonderful organization called Chabad. They provide rabbis in almost every single city in the world, and many of the Chabad Shluchim are actually Mashgichim as well. There are others as well, not just Chabad, but you have a rabbi who you met and you trust, and he understands what you want, and you understand his abilities, and he is able to supervise in all sorts of countries. Don't ask me about how they get into Jordan and Pakistan and all those kinds of countries. COR doesn't certify in those areas, and I really don't know the answer to that question. Even in China, we don't do any supervision acts that I'm aware of in China, because it's difficult, because of the question. It's difficult to actually supervise properly in countries where you don't have a firm grip and a strong understanding of manufacturing practices. But it is a good question, and the answer is networking.
So I'm just going to come back to, first of all, the international supervision. When I was a shul rabbi, I sat on a committee of the RCA that oversaw the OU, which was a very big joke, to be honest. It went back to a deal in the 1950s in which the OU took over supervision of many things that were under local rabbis, and in exchange, there would be a group of rabbis who would then oversee what the OU was doing, but the OU were the kashrut professionals, and we didn't really know. So our job consisted of reading their reports and then asking them questions. So I read reports from rabbis who were going into Europe and going into Asia. They wrote remarkable travel logs about where they went and where they stayed, and there was some fantastic information about what to visit when you're on your downtime. But they do. They have not just Chabad, but they have rabbis of their own, so to speak, who would travel overseas and spend weeks and weeks and weeks in these different places, supervising particular runs. That was number one. Number two was, I wanted to go back to the question again. I had an additional thought. The question about consistency of what you're filing with the CRA and supervising products that don't necessarily require supervision. The entertainment one, I think that I said what I had to say about it. I think that it is consistent with advancing observance of Judaism. But in terms of the issue of supervising products that don't need it, and then saying to the CRA, I want a tax break because I am advancing Judaism by certifying products that do need it. So, to my mind, the tax break isn't funding the certification on the ones that don't need it. It's really for that which is the bulk of the business. But I think you have to really look at the business and say, what is it that we're doing? If 99 point whatever percent of our products are things that do require it, and we also put something on bottled water, this doesn't bother me. If, on the other hand, this becomes, a significant part of what one's business is, then I think you do have to ask, does that really warrant getting this? And then the last point, I think this is a point of distinction between what you're saying and what I'm saying, and I'm okay with that, and I hope that you are too, because I'm about to say it, is that I think when it comes to the products that don't require certification, I think the hotline is good, but I would want something more proactive for people, maybe a page on a website or something like that, something that's more easily accessible, because a lot of people aren't going to go to the length of calling a hotline or even emailing. But if something is readily available to say, this sort of thing doesn't require it, I think that would make the information more accessible for the public. Rabbi, thank you again very, very much.
Thank you very much.
And for anyone who hasn't yet, Daven Maariv, maybe we'll have Maariv in about 2 minutes. Thank you very much.